Lecture 11, Monasteries and Manuscripts.
As we have been observing the march of the Bible toward becoming a book, we have looked at the craft of producing manuscripts and the art of copying manuscripts, together with the inevitable human errors that are built into that whole process. We've surveyed many of the ancient versions of the scripture or translations of the Jewish and in particular the Christian Bible in antiquity. In this lecture, I turn to the social setting that enabled the Bible to shape European culture over the period of a millennium and a half, as we look at monasteries and the production of manuscripts within monasteries. Monasteries play a key role in the history of Christianity and in the story of the Bible alike. Monasteries of either men or women are intentional religious communities that are organized around worship and work and are dedicated to a life of full discipleship. Earliest monasticism in the East, which grew up in Syria and in Egypt at least by the 4th century, took an intensely ascetical form with an emphasis upon rigorous, physical, demanding asceticism, sexual abstinence, fasting, sometimes even the abuse of the body, and largely featured the individual, the hermit, or perhaps a semi-eremitical life in which monks would spend much of their time alone in prayer and asceticism, but gather together only for common prayer or for common meals. The emphasis then in Eastern monasticism tended to be upon the extraordinary ascetic man who had fled the world to go out into the wilderness to fight the devil, to fight the flesh. And so there developed in the East, in particular, as Peter Brown has described it, the cult of the holy man. An example would be Simon Stylites, who sat upon a pillar for decades, demonstrating complete control over his body and preaching to the people from this elevated pillar. Simon was, in fact, the first of a whole crew of Stylites from the 5th to the 10th century. But the emphasis was on the individual and on the eremitic life. In the West, following the lead of John Cashin, who had visited the monks in Egypt and had brought to Marseille, when he lived as a monk, the conferences and institutes of the ideals of the Egyptian monks. Following John Cashin, but especially following Benedict of Nursia, whose dates are 480 to 550, and whose rule for monks was one of the classic works of Western civilization. The emphasis in monasticism in the West was cenobitic. The word cenobite means common life. And the emphasis here was less on the individual than on the community. With St. Basil in the East and Augustine in the West, Benedict of Nursia was convinced that the greatest asceticism wasn't lack of food, wasn't lack of sex, wasn't lack of drink, but it was living in humility under a rule and an abbot, living a life of obedience, which he saw as imitation of the obedience of Christ. And when people did that in a real community, which one never really left, that was the most severe form of life possible. Now, from the 5th to the 16th century, monasteries were the most vibrant centers of Christianity, both in the East and the West. These were people who were very serious about their commitment to Christianity. They fled the world, which means that they rejected what they saw as the wealth and the power and in their eyes, the mediocrity of Constantinian Christianity, in order to try to regain something of the original zeal of Christianity. If they could not die as martyrs anymore, they wanted to live their life in what was called white martyrdom, that is, a life of deep devotion and dedication. Now, because of their attention both to prayer and work, the phrase ora et labora derives from the rule of Benedict, monasteries in the West in particular played a number of critical social roles in addition to the strictly religious. For example, monastic schools were places where young people could learn grammar and rhetoric, as well as the higher arts of philosophy and theology, all of which, of course, were centered in the study of Scripture in this period. Second, monasteries preserved and extended the crafts of agriculture, both within and outside the cloister. Indeed, it is to monks that credit must be given for, in effect, the spread of agricultural practices in Europe. Third, monasteries were islands of relative literacy and of strict order in a world where illiteracy reigned and civilization was indeed fragile. This is the West after the collapse of the Roman order, in a period where illiteracy was by far the dominant reality among people, and thus has sometimes been called the Dark Ages. As monasteries grew in size and prosperity, as their industry and reception of benefits enabled them to grow, they became virtual cities and the center for the production and the preservation of biblical manuscripts. It is one of the paradoxes of the monastic life that although individual monks own nothing and are therefore live lives of poverty, the combination of benefits given to monasteries and the economic mode of life in which all hold everything in common means that monasteries, especially in this period, tended to prosper, tended to grow larger. And although they began with a deep commitment to poverty, often grew in wealth. In the East, sites such as Mount Athos, with its 20 monasteries dating to the 10th century, and the monastery of St. Catherine on Mount Sinai, which dates from the 6th century, were capable of copying and storing manuscripts. And in the West, the great Abbey of Cluny from the 10th century eventually stood at the head of more than 1,000 other monasteries. And Monte Cassino, founded by Benedict himself around the year 529, was famous both for its great size and the splendor of its scriptorium, the place where manuscripts were copied. Now, Benedictine monks, and after them, the Cistercians, and then the Cistercians of the Strict Observance, and the Carthusians, all of these other varieties of monks represented efforts to reform Benedictine monastery, which in the eyes of the Cistercians and others had itself grown to affluent. But Benedictine monasticism was the fundamental model for monasticism in Europe in the Middle Ages. Benedictine monks sought to live in imitation of biblical saints and spent much of their lives immersed in the Bible. The basic structure of the monastic life imitated the apostolic church as it was described in the Acts of the Apostles, chapters 2 and 4. If you will recall, the description of the first believers after Pentecost in Jerusalem said that they listened to the teaching of the apostles, they shared their possessions, they ate their meals in common, and they devoted their lives to prayer. This was precisely the ideal of the monastic life, to center life around those activities. In some sense, the monks had the same sort of religious instinct that we will find later in the Protestant Reformation, to get back to simpler times, to origins, in order to live a life of greater dedication. So in the monasteries, obedience to the written rule and to the abbot's interpretation of that rule, the sharing of possessions, and devotion to a life of prayer were regarded as ways of radical discipleship as revealed in Scripture itself. Monks regarded themselves as continuing the life of the earliest Christians. And if one reads through the Rule of Benedict, which was the most influential of all these monastic texts, one sees that virtually every aspect of the monastic day, silence, work, manual labor or intellectual work, meals, times of prayer, commitment through the vows, were supported by reference to Scripture. Benedict drew everything in his understanding of Scripture. The meaning of the phrase work and prayer, ora et labora, was distinct, however, for two categories of monks in the medieval monastery, the choir monks and the lay brothers. Choir monks spent more than 4 hours a day performing the Opus Dei. Now, I have to clarify that term because of a recent novel and because of recent historical developments. The term Opus Dei, which means literally the work of God, might well be misunderstood by those who are hearing or seeing this course. In the 20th century, a religious movement founded by a Spanish priest, dedicated to a kind of deeply right-wing understanding of Catholicism and of political action, took on the term Opus Dei, work of God. And in the notorious novel The Da Vinci Code, a crazed monk from this organization, Opus Dei, is the villain of the piece. It's important to recognize that the basic meaning of this term had nothing to do with such a religious organization, but referred to the work of God, which was prayer in the monastic context. So the choir monks spent more than 4 hours of every day performing this Opus Dei. They made solemn vows of commitment. They were ordained as priests, and therefore they received an appropriate education, learning Latin grammar and rhetoric, sufficient to enable them to read these texts. Their work, correspondingly, was more intellectual in character. Lay brothers, in contrast, only made simple vows, had a less arduous form of prayer, and spent longer hours in the manual labor that sustained the community's economic life. Lay brothers tended to be drawn from the people of the surrounding areas who wanted steady work, and so they joined the life of the monastery, but they were the ones who plowed the fields, milked the cows, rang the bells, and waited on tables. Now, the recitation or singing of the Opus Dei, the work of God in Latin, organized the life of the choir monk. The choir monk's day was divided into 8 hours of prayer in common. That is, 8 hours in quotation marks. Actually, as I suggested, took up about 4 to 4.5 hours. The longest period of prayer, matins, took place in the middle of the night. And then during the day, there were lauds in very early morning, dawn, prime, terced, sext, none. Notice these mark the hours of the day, 1, 3, 6, and 9th hour. Then vespers in the evening, and then compline as an evening prayer. The other work of the monastery, whether it was manual or intellectual, fitted into and between these times of prayer. During these times of prayer, the recitation or singing of the Psalms dominated. Throughout the week, the entire Psalter was recited in choir, with some Psalms repeated many times. Benedict, in his rule, in fact, complains about the laziness of monks in his own day. He says, it takes us a whole week to do what our ancestors did in a single day. That is, if you were living alone out in the wilderness, it was possible to read through the entire 150 Psalms in a single day. In addition to the Psalms, Canticles drawn from the New Testament also formed parts of Lauds, Vespers, and Compline. During that longest session of prayer called Matins, monks also listened to sermons and treatises concerning the Bible drawn from the fathers of the church, Basil, Augustine, Ambrose, and Gregory the Great. So during Matins, which lasted about an hour and a half usually, monks would sit and listen to these scriptural readings and respond to them by the praying of the Psalms. The daily celebration of the Eucharist, or the Mass, was also part of the choir monk's day. Usually for the ordained priests, the choir monks, the low Mass would be celebrated in private at a side altar in the church, and then the high Mass would be celebrated by the abbot and with everybody else there in common. And the Eucharist offered another opportunity for engaging scripture within still another format. Finally, choir monks ordinarily spent at least 2 hours a day in contemplative prayer or meditative prayer. And in Benedictine monasteries, the basic source of this contemplative prayer was what was called holy reading, Lectio Divina. And Lectio Divina was always either scripture or the reading of patristic literature. Jean Leclerc describes this monastic culture with the wonderful phrase, the love of learning and the desire for God. It was these two things that characterized the monastic life in the High Middle Ages. And this combination of love of learning and the desire for God came together in the work of the monastic scriptorium, in which everything was done by hand. The life of the choir monks, remember, demanded the production of a considerable number of distinct books. And in large communities, some of these communities numbered 1,000 monks, books in large numbers, simply to carry out the work of God. So although many monks memorized the entire Psalter and could recite it from memory, Psalters were required for the recitation of the Psalms and the other canticles from the New Testament, at least one for every 3 monks, so 3 monks could read from a single book. And such volumes would need more frequent replacement because of heavy use. Other books, lectionaries, which organize passages of Scripture according to the liturgical year, which we'll talk about later, were used for the public reading of Scripture in the Divine Office and also at Mass. Other books contained graduals and antiphonals that guided the singing of responses and versicles during the office and at Mass. So a large number of books were needed to be produced simply to do the activity of the monastery in choir. The work of God demanded a scriptorium simply to provide the manuscripts that were needed by the monks themselves. In addition to all of these manuscripts for the continuing prayer life of the community, trained scribes gave their talents to the copying of biblical manuscripts, not only for the monasteries, but also as they were needed in churches in a particular region. It was the monasteries that had the social context and the technological skill to be, in fact, the book publishers of the Middle Ages, which is to say, the manuscript copiers of the Middle Ages. Such copying was a combination of intellectual and manual labor. If you have not tried to copy out extensive portions of any text at all, you may not have a grasp on what hard physical labor this is. And it was carried out with devotion in less than comfortable circumstances. You have to remember this was a period in which people living in stone buildings experienced extremes of cold in winter and heat in summer. They were working with instruments of less than easy malleability and very often had to carry out the work of copying in light that was far less than adequate. Throughout the medieval period, monks copied both Greek and Latin manuscripts of the Bible. They continued this practice, remarkably, even after the invention of printing. We have some biblical manuscripts that date from as late as the 17th century. At the same time, monks made copies of other literature, both sacred, such as the ones used in the liturgical life of the community, and also profane. Many of the works from the classical period of Greece and Rome have come down to us over all these centuries through the labors of anonymous monks in monasteries. Among other things that were copied in the scriptorium were compilations of commentaries, such as the Glossa Ordinaria, or Common Gloss, that was begun under Anselm of Laon around the year 1117 and continued to be developed within the monastic tradition. The Glossa Ordinaria was drawn from extracts of the fathers of the church, the patristic authors, and they were both written in an interlinear fashion and in a marginal fashion in copies of the Bible that were produced. Now, it must be said that this aspect of interpretation within the monastic tradition was the least interesting. Biblical commentaries throughout the whole medieval period tended to be not very original in their content, but rather carried on and transmitted the kinds of interpretations that had been found centuries earlier. Because of all of this scribal activity that took place in this social setting, monasteries were natural repositories for manuscripts. And so the scriptorium also then grew into monastic libraries. And extensive manuscript libraries were developed in these great monasteries, such as Monte Cassino and Cluny. Unfortunately for the monks, such libraries were easy prey for looting. When monasteries were dissolved during the Protestant Reformation in countries such as Germany and England, the libraries of the monks were looted and manuscripts were scattered to nobility and to universities and to museums. Fortunately, a number of them were saved and thus became available to scholars in the 19th century who became interested in discovering and using these ancient manuscripts, a topic to which I will return in a later presentation called The Romance of Manuscripts. The monastic scriptorium also provided the setting for two artistic expressions that centered on the Bible. Ingenious and often profound interpretations of biblical texts were developed literarily in the composition of antiphons and responses, and these in turn were deepened through musical expression in Gregorian chant. Here is where the real genius of medieval biblical interpretation took place. Both at Mass in the Eucharist and in the Divine Office, the recitation or singing of the Psalms was interspersed by responses, antiphons, and versicles. These were composed by the monks anonymously and with great ingenuity wove together verses from various places in Scripture that reflected both an interpretation of the biblical text and an interpretation of the particular liturgical feast that was being celebrated, either as part of the Easter cycle, let us say, or the celebration of a particular saint, like Mary. these highly imaginative and inventive artistic renderings of the scriptural text were then elaborated progressively in a form of cantillation or chant, so that Gregorian chant, as it is called, developed as a system of musical markings to show how monks were to inflect those antiphons and versicles and then also voice them. Gregorian chant then in the 12th and 13th century became an ever more elaborate melismatic form of musical expression, which in turn became interpretive, so that some of the great Gregorian chants, such as Christus factus est obedience, the gradual that was sung on Holy Thursday, Christ became obedient unto death, is really a musical masterpiece. But all of this is interpretation of the scripture. A second form of artistic expression was the art of biblical illumination, where copyists would not simply write out the text in as elegant a way as they could manage, but also began to develop their own artistic expression through the ornamentation in particular of the capital letters that began chapters and books of the Bible. These would often be rendered in splendid multicolors, would show biblical scenes in vivid colors, and extend various kinds of tendrils over the pages. Sometimes these were astonishing expressions of beauty, as in the justly famous Book of Kells, which is presently in the city of Dublin. Now, in evaluating this very long period of monastic dominance in the West, a period of about a millennium to a millennium and a half, it is important to avoid two extremes in evaluating this phenomenon. On the one side, I think it's important to avoid what might be called Catholic Romanticism. One famous Catholic historian spoke of the 13th as the greatest of centuries. It is important not to be too romantic about the monastic life. Corruption did come into play. Wealth did come into play. Monasteries didn't reform society as a whole. They tended to be isolated islands of civility and culture in that world. On the other side, it is equally important to avoid what might be called Protestant polemics against the monastic life that developed during the time of the Reformation. For Martin Luther, for Henry VIII, the monasteries were favorite targets for everything that they regarded as wrong with medieval Catholicism, and so tended to emphasize the wealth and the power and the corruption. I think some middle ground between those extremes is appropriate. I think at the very least it can be said that monasteries represent among the most intense and intentional expressions of the Christian life that have ever existed. And at the very least, our sketch of how the Bible was at the center of this life and how monks lived within the imaginative world of Scripture showed that they took the Bible and its promises very seriously indeed.